podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Over the next few podcasts, we're working in partnership with Beer 52. To get a free case of 8 unique beers, head to www.beer52.com/wisden or use the code wisden at beer52.com when ordering and cover just the postage costs of $5.95. Beer 52 is the world's largest beer club with over 175,000 active members. Each month, members are sent a case with a different theme. Past themes have included Belgium, North and South Korea, California, New Zealand, and many more. This week, we had a delivery to the office, and the Escapist IPA from Temperance Beer Company was an absolute winner. Your package comes with a magazine and two snacks, and if you don't like dark beer, you can choose the light option. And you can pause or cancel your subscription at any time. So head to www.beer52.com/wisden to order your package today. Hello and welcome to the Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast, a slightly different show for you today. We've got pre-recorded interviews with 100 Star and one of the CPL's latest signings, Jake Lintott, and Glamorgan's one-day cup winning skipper, Kieran Carlson, who's also been one of the standout first-class batsmen in the country this year. Butch is on the road covering the Blast, but we'll still hear his thoughts on England ahead of the third India Test. And in the studio, I'm joined by magazine editor of Wisden Cricket Monthly, Joe Harmon, and features editor of Wisden.com, Tahar Hashim. We'll kick things off with Butch, who I spoke to earlier today. England have announced a change squad for this test. Sibley, Crawley out, Milan in. Woods out injured, Saqib and Overton are the spare quicks in the squad. Butch, what do you make of the decision to bring in Milan?
I think it's a good decision, really. It's pretty pragmatic. It's been calling for somebody of a bit of experience to sort of join Joe Root in that top order for a while now. I suppose you could say that the advantage of the amount of runs that he'd made in first class cricket is now no longer relevant because of the amount of time that's passed since he played any Red Bull stuff. But I think it's better that than guys who are kind of trying to make their way and have had failure upon failure kind of bank up behind them. And what England need is a bit of solidity. So hopefully Milan will provide that. And of course, massive incentive for him is that with the Ashes coming up, there is a spot there. He's made runs in Australia before. And, you know, according to previous selectors, he can only bat in Australian conditions and not in English ones. So he's got a real chance to get himself on that plane.
Yeah, it's interesting. He's never batted in the top three in Test cricket and his record in England really isn't that good. But I completely get what you're saying. On the Wood replacement question, Mahmood seems to be the people's pick to replace Wood. From what you've seen of him, do you think he's ready to be a Test cricketer?
Yeah, I think so. And I think you also have to look at what he's replacing as well. England have the seam up, nagging accuracy, contingent cover, don't they, in Anderson and Robinson. I'm presuming that Sam Curran plays again. I mean, I'm not sure that's the way I would go. But anyway, that's by the by. That's not the question you're asking. And so in replacing Wood, you'd want to replace him with Saqib, somebody who has a little bit of extra pace, a little bit of X factor. Might help them out knocking the tail over, which England obviously had an absolute nightmare with at Lord's. So, yeah, that's the way I'd go to.
And while I've got you, it's been 20 years since your famous 173 at Leeds. Just very quickly, what are your thoughts as you cross that milestone?
I'm very old. That's basically it. I'm very, very old. I'm still very grateful for that day. It kind of it changed a lot of things in my life, and I'm still living off it now.
Well, I was digging some stats out for this week, and I saw that you averaged over 50 in home tests this century from a pretty good sample size, which is pretty good. Anyway, enjoy your week in the Blast. I'm sure you'll tell us all about it next week.
Yes, indeed. That juke ball is not as dangerous as they say it is, you know.
Tahar, we picked out the 11s we'd like to see England select for Wisden.com yesterday. With so many first-choice players missing, it doesn't look hugely inspiring.
Right, okay. Upbeat start to the day. Yeah, I mean, you say that, but I think we're expecting to see Dawid Malan at three. I think that's a pretty positive selection. I think that's it's probably the right move. I think people have been talking about it, but and a lot's been said about the fact that he's not had much red ball prep, much like the rest of that team before the series. But if you look to his record over just the last 3 years, every time he has faced a red ball, he's done really well. I think he's averaging, since the start of 2019, when he was at Middlesex, he's averaging 56 or something with a bat in first-class cricket. Ever since he's joined Yorkshire, every time he bats in red ball cricket for them, he gets runs. But beyond that, it's also just the fact that this is a player who we know he can handle international cricket. He's done it as England's T20I number three. Of course, that's a different format, a whole different ball game, but there's still the almost reliability that he can sort of handle that pressure, that scrutiny of playing international cricket. I mean, he's been batting in a very scrutinized position for the last 2 years as England's T20I number three. So that's a mental thing that you have to deal with, and he's dealt with it pretty well, I think. So I think that's one reason to be optimistic if you're an England fan. Mark Wood getting injured, having bowled really quite well in that last test, is obviously a reason to be downbeat. But what we kind of we might see is a debut for Saqib Mahmood, who's really looked the part this summer in County Championship when he played against Pakistan in those ODIs. He bowled brilliantly, and he's that, you can always see he's that kind of point of difference bowler. That's slightly different from just your right arm metronomic. He's right arm, but he's slingy. He's got the nice seam position, but he's also someone who reverses it. So there's an excitement there, but he's obviously battling with Craig Overton, who's been in and around squads and actually really does deserve a go at some point. And so we'll see what happens there. I mean, there's also the possibility, I was thinking, you know, with Sam Curran, whether he kind of, the magic kind of isn't there right now with him. And for me, I've talked about him playing at seven because I do see him as an all-rounder. And it'd be weird to big him up as an all-rounder now he's coming off a pair. But if he's not that all-rounder sort of balancing the side, if you're going to go for the fourth seamer at eight, I'm thinking maybe Overton fits at the bill right now. And he's someone who can bat as well. And so you'd have Overton and Mahmood. Whether England go down that route, I don't know. But yeah, like you said, there's just so many injuries, lots of, you know, opportunities for players coming back in, new players, and we'll see what happens. England obviously have not been in the greatest position, but I wouldn't say it's all doom and gloom.
Joe, what do you think? What do you think about Milan's recall? A look at the England team now with Milan back in it, Bairstow in it, Moeen in it. Three players you wouldn't really expect to be playing home test matches a year ago and being ahead of the likes of Ollie Pope and Dan Lawrence in the pecking order. What do you make of Milan's return?
Yeah, by the time we get to the Ashes, we might have exactly the same team as we went to with the Ashes last time.
Where's Jake Ball?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think I said last week on the show that I would have perhaps tried to get Ollie Pope back in at three, but I can absolutely understand that would be a risk given he hasn't played much cricket, given his form hasn't been great. I can see that Milan is the sensible, pragmatic option at this stage. Sure, yeah, he's not played much red ball cricket, but none of them have really. And the ones that have haven't gone so well. So I can see it's a sensible move. I think the jury's out. He hasn't got a great record when he's played home test in England. He hasn't got a very good record at all, in fact. But he does seem to be a better player now than when he last got his chance. So that, yeah, I think the right pick. We just have to hope it works out. And Taha raising the point about Sam Curran, I wouldn't pick him for this test. I would go Overton and Mahmood, get them both in. I think Overton, Robinson, 8-9 is fine, really. Butler, Moeen, 6 and 7 is a bit of a concern based on weight of runs, but we're not able to fix that at this point. And I don't think Sam Curran is adding a hell of a lot more with the bat than Craig Overton at this point. Overton's had a really good year with the bat for Somerset earlier in the year. So that's the way I'd go. We'll have to see.
Yeah, I'd go exactly the same, actually. On Milan, I think it is quite interesting that, you know, you can always manipulate stats to tell the story that you want them to say. So you gave the example of him averaging 57 in first-class cricket since the start of 2019. But he also averages 20 in home test matches, has the third worst average among top six batsmen to play six or more home tests for England this century. He's never batted three in Test cricket. He's only batted once in first-class cricket this year, and though he scored 199, there were three teenagers and a 20-year-old in the Sussex attack he faced against. So I'm not writing him off at all. He's a player I'd have picked.
That optimism that Taha had just been built up has just been burst immediately.
I completely get...
Being accused of being manipulative as well.
I completely get why England have picked him. I'd have picked him as well. Just, these are the times that we live in at the moment. And Joe, on Mahmood, I think I'd pick him, but there's probably a 50-50% chance, maybe slightly more, that he plays. What do you think we can expect from him if he does play?
I think it's hugely exciting. I think we've been talking about him for a long time, and we thought white ball was his best route into the England side. Couldn't really quite see how he'd get into the red ball team for a while, and then England had just been decimated with injuries, particularly the bowlers who can crank it up above 85 miles an hour. So suddenly he has become incredibly valuable, and particularly looking ahead to this winter. Mark Wood's injury is hopefully only a minor thing that should be fixed, but we know his track record is not good. He's not going to get 3-5 Ashes tests. Jofra is obviously not going to be seen. So Mahmood has suddenly been kind of elevated from hugely exciting, promising talent to being actually potentially really quite key to the next few months for England. And I think it's absolutely right to get him in for this game. He would be my first pick of those three, of Overton, Curran, Mahmood, and then I would lean towards Overton for the fourth pick. I think England has to take a look at him. I think he, not only the way he bowled in that, the ODI replacements series, but the way he led that attack and the way he grasped that responsibility, and he's clearly a very smart bowler. So I think that's hugely exciting. Can't wait to see him.
For me, I've kind of been excited by him as a red ball bowler ever since watching that game for Lancs against Yorkshire earlier this season, where he kind of bowled Lancs to the win, and you could see just the fact that he was like he'd come back at the end of the day and still bowl, you know, rapid. He was getting the ball to tail in, and he was just, it was him and Parkinson from the other end, and it was just exciting to watch. And we'll see if he gets.
And Joe Root really bigged him up yesterday.
I think so, yeah. And you know, he's been. I mean, there are plenty of reasons to big him up. I mean, just like we said, you know, the way he kind of led that attack against Pakistan, it was impressive. It was a side of him that we'd not seen since he'd come into international cricket, where he'd been bigged up initially in 2019, but kind of had been quiet and not really made that sort of impression that we thought he was going to. And now I think ever since he's come back from the PSL earlier this year, he's really looked the part. He's looked the bowler that people were talking about.
That felt quite a significant tournament for him, didn't it? And I think, just to manage expectations a bit here as well, I mean, the performance that Taha mentions at Headingley, that was his first 5-wicket haul in first-class cricket, I think. He hasn't taken one since, not that he's played much since. So, you know, these stats don't jump out. He's definitely one of those players, unlike Overton and Robinson, who have built a kind of unanswerable case in Championship cricket. Mahmood hasn't done that. His is based on potential and what we actually see in front of us when he plays now, whatever the format. And there's definitely enough there for him to deserve this, but we should also remember that he's actually only played... he's played 22 first class games. That's not a lot at all, and he's not had a proper season of first class cricket, partly because he keeps getting pulled into England squad. So every reason to be excited, but let's also manage expectations. Let's not get overly excited and then say, oh, he's not up to it if an innings don't quite go the way we want it to, because there's every chance that will happen. Doesn't mean he's not a hugely exciting prospect.
It's actually for that reason is why I'd pick Overton ahead of Curran, is that Mahmood, not that experienced, but you kind of want him in the team because he can be your X-factor bowler. He doesn't bowl as quickly as Wood, I know that, but he can be the point of difference bowler. And I think you want him to kind of be attacking and bowl, not bowl within himself at all. And I think if it does go wrong, I think you kind of do want Overton as your other seamer, as someone who will be dependable, is unlikely to go more than 2.5 and over and alongside Robinson Anderson. I think you can afford that luxury of Mahmood if you've got Overton in the side.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's, obviously you lose the left armour, but I think you make up that balance in other ways.
Yeah, well, we won't dwell much further than the test given it starts so soon. A reminder that we will have our daily YouTube videos that you can watch, technology permitting, couple of hours after play each day. Before we go on with the show, we're recording a lot of our podcast at the moment from Sixes Cricket Club. If you've not heard about Sixes Cricket Club is the new cricket-themed social entertainment venue with restaurant, bar and cricket nets. all Wisden Cricket Weekly podcast listeners can receive 10% off their food and drink by quoting Wisden10 on their booking notes. There are a couple of locations in London and a new one opening up in Manchester very, very soon. Zaha, what's your moment of the week?
My moment of the week was actually watching Liam Livingstone in the flesh for the first time. It was kind of weird to think that. I thought I'd probably seen him bat before, but it kind of dawned on me while watching him in the 100 final that I was kind of watching him for real for the first time. And he is just an exhilarating player to watch. He's had an incredible summer for England, and then to be the player of the tournament at the 100. And he's got this sort of, there's an excitement about him that the special players kind of exude, and that you're watching Birmingham bat and you're kind of weighing, okay, Livingstone's going to come. And then he comes and then kind of delivers almost immediately. He just hits it harder than and further away than, you know, any other cricketer in England right now. He's a special, special player. And so Birmingham obviously had quite a big chase. And he was the one who you thought, okay, if they're going to win this, it's Livingstone's going to do it. And he was 40 off, you know, nothing. And he was run out by Tim David.
That's my moment of the week.
Right. from the boundary.
Who'd already taken an absolute one-handed screamer first up, hadn't he?
Yeah.
Without a squad number in his back.
Yeah. And then that was the game. It was basically done then. Moeen Ali was still at the other end and maybe a bit rusty with how he's batting. So you couldn't really see him. He would have had to improve the way he was batting, you know, significantly to take Birmingham over the line. But that was the game. There and it was such a disappointment because it was kind of building up to it. Right, 100 final, Livingstone, you know, goes ballistic, you know, that would be a really special, memorable occasion, and he just, yeah, the bales lit up and you're like,
it was a brilliantly entertaining moment that completely ruined the game, wasn't it, it was kind of an odd, like, oh, what a fantastically exhilarating moment, and then actually the whole thing faded to nothing.
Just
after
like,
that,
oh no,
I don't think anyone in that ground, apart from maybe the players and coaching staff of the Brave, wanted that to happen. I think even Brave fans wanted Phoenix to get a bit closer there. He's just so good to watch at the moment. I'm getting quite kind of strong Kevin Peterson 2004 2005 vibes of that, just arrival, and it looks like he can do anything, and it looks like he thinks he can do anything. There's that kind of that swagger, that posturing, kind of ego. But I think Livingstone's got a lot more charm about him than Peterson as well. There's a sort of like tongue-in-cheekness to it.
I think people really like him.
Yeah, which there never was with Peterson.
I think supporters really like him. There've been a couple of moments. There was a moment when he was mic'd up in the Big Bash where he just showed that he's like quite a funny guy. He doesn't take himself that seriously. And I thought there was almost like a Stokes-like quality to that innings, in that I was watching the game with a few people who aren't like massive into cricket. One of them is, I guess, but people shut up and watched him bat.
Yeah.
You know, people who aren't really into cricket, it's like, this guy's like really compelling. It's
Livingstone just signs up in the crowd as well. It's like, it's an amazing few months for him, because within sort of geeky cricket, for want of a better phrase, he's been talked about for a long time, but now he has been kind of elevated to a completely different level, and now he's potentially a couple of months away from being a kind of world superstar. If he carries this form into the T20 World Cup, he will be that.
He's just got such a pure swing of the bat that I haven't seen. Sometimes it's just so mechanical with players, but it's just so, I don't know, there's a thing about him where you might watch him and you think, oh, I might be able to do that. You know, actually, he just swings it.
From having watched you, I don't think.
So, thanks, Joe. Thanks, Joe. Yeah. Cheers for that.
Oh, I didn't think we were going to bring up that match.
No. Let's not go there. I didn't even bat. He's so fun to watch. And it's incredible because a few months ago, he would have started the summer thinking, okay, whether he could make a case to even just get into that T20 World Cup squad. And now it's almost hard to see how he just doesn't. Like, he has to be in that 11, surely.
It's now just how you use him best, I think, is the question, rather than how you get him into the side. I think that question has changed. And also, looking a little bit further ahead, we were kind of discussing this earlier, that, as I was saying, there's some Peterson vibes here. And I think as well that if England's test cricket continues on the same path and Livingstone has a standout T20 World Cup, then come an Ashes squad, I wouldn't be surprised if he's in there as a kind of a wild card pick, basically because we've sort of exhausted the options that have actually scored any runs in Red Bull cricket. He looks like he's got the personality and character to see succeed out there. He's got no fear of fast bowling. And we're not talking about a guy who has no red ball record. He's toured with England's test side before in New Zealand, was very close, very unlucky not to get a test debut. He hasn't played much red ball cricket for ages, but then neither has Milan, and he's back in at number three in a marquee test series. So it might sound ridiculous, and the skills are clearly not transferable in so many ways. And it might all go wrong in a kind of Jason Roy style way, but I don't think it's that unlikely at this stage. And it would be pretty exciting to see.
If there's one place in the world you think a white ball superstar who hasn't played much red ball cricket could possibly thrive, it is probably Australia as well. True pitches, ball doesn't do quite as much as it does elsewhere. So yeah, that is very exciting. But yeah, the 100 came to its really end this weekend. We had the eliminators and the finals. And I thought what was most remarkable actually is we got two full games in, given the forecast, which was great. Bit of a shame that the two finals weren't that close, but a great spectacle nevertheless. I thought it's worth mentioning a couple of the lesser, well, not quite as well-known names who did really well in the final. Ross Whiteley doing what he's been doing in the Blast for a long time with a rapid 44 at the death. And you mentioned Tim David, but it was with the bat as well, 15 off 6, as well as that brilliant catch and that direct hit. The women's final was done and dusted pretty quickly. Southern Brave, the standout side in the group stage, were blown away by Oval Invincibles, who had them 14 for 6 at one stage in the run chase. Marazan capped the star, scoring a quick 26 and then taking 4 for 9 with the ball. A quick word on Alice Capsey, by the way, who turned 17 during the tournament. She finished as Oval's second leading run scorer. Of the Oval batters to face 50 or more balls, she had the highest strike rate, and she also took 10 wickets at 12 with an economy rate of less than 6, which is just ridiculous.
Just on that women's final, all those people who might be complaining about, you know, who are traditionalists and might be complaining about the 100, Marazan Kapp had Sophia Dunkley, who's had an incredible summer, caught at second slip, and I just thought that was just a nice little touch in the final, the first final of the 100.
Yeah. Joe, you want to talk about Adam Milne?
I've watched him for a number of years, and he's obviously always been a very kind of exciting box office bowler. A little bit hit and miss is how I've kind of characterised him. He was very much hit pretty much every ball of the whole competition. Joint leading wicket taker for the tournament, going at under a run a ball, and bowling about 90 miles an hour on average, just hitting those Yorkers at will. It's pretty astonishing that he's New Zealand's standby player, isn't he, for their T20 World Cup squad. I mean, I know they've got plenty of good seamers, but I think he'd be in any team in the world at the moment. I'm sure England would dearly love to have him. So impressive. And I thought, you know, he's probably not your A-lister. He's not your Andre Russell. He's not your Kieran Pollard. But in terms of the skills he showed in that tournament, you wouldn't see any better in any tournament across the world. And I thought that Phoenix attack was... Phoenix's batting was definitely their strength. They didn't have the strongest bowling attack, and he really carried them, along with Benny Howe, through the group stage and into the final.
We were hoping to speak to Tash Farrant, who's part of the Oval side. We couldn't speak to her in time for today's show, but we will by the next episode after the third England-India Test match. I think this is obviously got a good time to kind of talk about what we thought about the 100 overall. The ECB announced some headline numbers. I'm not sure what we can really make of them, but I'll read them out and see what you think of them. So 57% of viewers hadn't watched any other live ECB cricket in 2021. There were 16.1 million people who watched it in the UK, which is more than the 2019 Men's World Cup. 55% of ticket buyers hadn't bought a ticket for cricket in this country before. And attendance across the competition is the highest ever for a women's cricket event globally ever, which is obviously brilliant. I didn't read out the numbers I was a bit more sceptical about. There was a number they cited for the number of social media views they had, which was 34 million, which I actually don't think is that much, given that you've got so many highlights you can put up and show
sure.
the world.
Well, that's because you work in social media. Yeah. Other people were like, wow, yeah. That's a huge number. Yeah. So I was impressed.
And also app downloads. You had to buy the app to go to the game, so obviously people had to...
Yeah, they were winning that one, weren't they?
They were going to win that one. But overall, Joe, a year in, what are your impressions?
I enjoyed it. I thought the cricket was good. The women's competition was a revelation. We used the word game changer, a nauseating amount, but I think in this sense it was another example of that. I really enjoyed what I watched. We've talked about this before a little bit, but I was surprised and pleased by the level of support that the local teams got. I thought crowds really seemed to get behind them, buying up the merchandise, getting behind local players. That was really encouraging, and I think something I didn't necessarily expect to see in year one. And I thought it all ran a lot more smoothly. We chatted about some of the things that we thought might be an issue, like timing and basically whether everyone would know the rules to start with, or how quickly umpires would get up to speed. But I thought that all went much more smoothly than, to be honest, I expected. So in terms of the actual product of what I saw, I wouldn't really have any quibbles with it. The major questions of the ripple effect it has in terms of England's test fortunes, let's be honest, we're on the slide before the 100 arrived anyway, and perhaps most importantly, the impact it has on the 18-county model is still very much up for grabs. I saw Harry Gurney tweeting the other day saying that the success of the 100 proves that the Blast is almost already obsolete. Did he see this?
No, I didn't know.
Which, you know, he's played in the Blast. He knows what he's talking about, but he is there already expressing the greatest fears of some county fans, and we haven't even got through the first edition of the 100 at that point. So look, I can absolutely understand if you're a fan of a county and you feel like you're getting marginalised, why you would feel like that. Absolutely, and that is an ongoing concern. But if we're looking at it in isolation as a tournament and how enjoyable it was, I thought it was a big success.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I'd just echo everything Joe would say. I think that the women's competition has been the main thing. I mean, by the end, we kind of got used to just seeing, you know, thousands of people at women's domestic cricket match, which a year ago, I mean, it was just weird how we just got kind of used to it. It just flicked like that from the first game, and that was that. And it was incredible to see how much it meant to those women's players as well to be there, because they must have had the understanding that we're part of something really special here. And that's different from the men's competition, because those guys have played in front of these kind of crowds before. You know, they've played these kind of big finals before. But you sense that at Lourdes the other day, just how big an occasion it all was. Also with the merchandise thing, I went as a fan to the Eliminator, and I saw how crestfallen one of my good friends was when he discovered the Oval Invincibles bucket hats had sold out.
Oh no. Yeah. What a shame.
Just another quick positive from it as well. I thought the Blast wildcard thing worked brilliantly. Mm. Some of the names that came through that, Blake Cullen, one at Middlesex, who I spoke to just yesterday, actually, a very impressive young man, an impressive young bowler who I think is going to go far in the game. Jake Lintott was another wildcard pick, right? Yeah. That is a really good thing in itself, because it ties the two competitions together. It gives a bit more to the Blast. And I think anything they can do to promote that as the competition's going on, that commentators should be mentioning it after the performances in the Blast, just to tie the two things together. So it doesn't necessarily feel like one is eating the other whole. They actually can complement each other. So that's another thing that I think worked well and could be even emphasised in the future.
On the women's competition, Charlotte Edwards literally said yesterday that the tournament has single-handedly changed women's cricket in this country. And I thought it was quite interesting. So Tom Harrison and Sanjay Patel, the ECB and 100 bosses respectively, did a media briefing yesterday. I thought one of the things that was interesting was they were visibly surprised at how successful the double headers were. So double headers weren't originally supposed to happen. It was a COVID enforced policy, and the actual crowd sizes for the women's game massively surpassed their expectations. And it sounds like it might even change how they schedule international women's cricket in this country, because England women just don't play in big cities. They've not played, I think I've said this stat before in the podcast, but they've not played a single game in the UK in a city with a population of over a million since they won the World Cup. They've not played a game in London since they won the World Cup. They very, very rarely play north of the Midlands. So I think that all has to change. Now there's evidence that you can get a big crowd for high-profile women's cricket. Another thing they touched on, they kind of vaguely alluded to learnings without really going into specifics. But the one learning they did talk about in a bit of detail, actually, was what the makeup of the crowd is like. They said that the crowds often weren't as family friendly as they could have been, and that was something they'd pinpointed as something being really key. And Tar, you've noticed a couple of times that they're not making that up. That is definitely true.
Yeah, no, this is 100%. I've seen it from the press box, where you've you know, you see all these kids, families at the women's games, and it's quite a nice wholesome atmosphere. And then you know the night sort of begins with the men's games, and it becomes. I was at Lords a few weeks ago, and it felt like I was at Freshers Week when I was leaving. It was a bit much for me. And then I was in the stands for the Eliminator games, and me and my friends were really enjoying the women's game, and then you know. Switch flicks once more with the men's games, and it got a bit. It was, you know, we weren't really enjoying where we were sat because of the behaviour of some individuals. So I've kind of seen it now, and it's when a tournament is so heavily focused on trying to appeal to families. It's, you know, if I was with, you know, with my parents or something, I would have just gone kind of left where I was sitting because of the behaviour of people in front of me. And so, yeah, I thought it was interesting that Tom Harrison kind of, you know, made this point about antisocial behavior.
And so if that's a learning, what's the solution?
Yeah, I don't even know.
Yeah, I'm not sure. And also, what's the implication? That isn't that not also saying then your other cricket crowds aren't accessible enough? It's an interesting problem to kind of notice and then potentially not do anything about, which is interesting. A couple of other points I thought worth talking about. A few players have talked about the kind of the standard of the competition, and they have kind of all said that there was a noticeable step up in quality. We'll hear from Lindsay later, but he talks about that. And then the other thing that Harrison and Patel mentioned is they admitted that the schedule wasn't ideal, which I think we could all work out. So I was wondering what your must-haves would be if you were creating your own schedule. What do you think you'd change? Ideal world, Joe Harmon, Tom Ashing, you're in charge of the ECB. What are the must-haves in the cricket schedule?
For the whole of the domestic season?
Yeah.
I think you should have prepped me for this one, yes?
Yeah.
Well, I think we've got to get some four-day cricket in the heart of summer.
Yeah.
I think that's got to be non-negotiable. How it is negotiated to happen is a different thing altogether. I don't see the 100 moving, really. I think that's going to stay where it is. Maybe you can start the blast a bit earlier. So you have a bit of a chunk of four-day cricket to start with, then you get into the blast a bit quicker than you have done previously, and then you go back to four-day cricket. Problem with that is we know the players hate jumping from one format to the next. So this is the problem. This is you need to sit down with an enormous sheet of paper and try about 40 different solutions before you can find, which actually is what we're going to try and do in the magazine in the next few months as well. Similarly to us rewriting the World Test Championship, which we still haven't heard from the ICC on that one, actually.
Really?
But
wow.
Anyway, I'm sure the ECB will be interested to hear our views on how to revamp the domestic schedule. But, you know, you're never going to get to a point where everyone is happy. I thought, actually, it was interesting speaking to Joe Cook of Glamorgan, who was the kind of their standout player, or one of their standout players in their One Day Cup victory. And he really enjoyed the One Day Cup experience, and he didn't feel like being part of it, they were sidelined. He felt like the crowds were good, which is what I've heard in general. They got a decent crowd even on a Thursday to the final, and they didn't feel like they were playing on the fringes whilst this big thing was going on, because there was enough interest in it from people who did still really care. So I think you can hopefully get to a point where there is such a wide range of cricket fans that even if there is cricket on at the same time, that's not necessarily a problem. You just pick the thing that suits you, or you flip between the two, and that doesn't have to be a problem.
But I think whatever you do, one or two competitions are going to be downgraded. Like, it's just something has to take a hit. Like,
sure, it's just encouraging. Yeah. The One Day Cup has clearly been downgraded,
yeah,
but it hasn't necessarily felt exactly like that to the people involved, whether they're playing it, whether they're watching it. And yeah, I mean, the concern is, The blast has a much more prized position in county cricket. So if that is perceived to be downgraded in any way, that is going to cause a lot of fuss, and rightly so.
Well, we've got a pre-recorded interview with Jake Lintott. He had a great tournament, very economical. Only four bowlers took more wickets than him. Earlier this year, he didn't even have a professional contract. Now he's a quarter finalist in the Blast of Warwickshire, a winner at the 100, and is about to jet off to the CPL for the first time, where he'll play for Barbados. Great to have you on the show. You've had a whirlwind 8 or so months. When we last spoke in January, you didn't have a contract for 2021. Now you're a quarter finalist in the Blast, a winner of the inaugural 100, and you're about to jet off to the Caribbean for the CPL. Is this beyond what you even dreamt of at the start of the year?
Yeah, I'd be lying if I said it wasn't. So it's gone very well. Obviously, it's been an amazing year or so, really, in terms of when I first started playing for Warwickshire all the way through to now. So, yeah, it's been a real whirlwind, like you say. It's been an exciting time and really proud of everything that's happened in the last year or so.
Mm. What was it like working under Mihaela Jai Warner at the Southern Brave? He's a man who's being dubbed as the Pep Guardiola of T20 cricket.
Yeah, it was brilliant. I mean, he's obviously one of the best players to ever play the game, which naturally a lot of respect comes with that. And but it was really interesting to see how he went about his business. Very relaxed in terms of preparation and how he expects us to prepare. So there was no real like pressure on us to be training all the time and putting, you know, working flat out, because it was more about doing what we needed to do to be ready. So he trusted his players, and yeah, you felt really trusted under him. And then the tactical side of it and the planning that he puts in is he's pretty meticulous in that regard.
Mm. As a wrist spin bowler, does that clarity help you when you get out on the field?
Yeah, 100%. He's worked with me ever since I played my first game, really, in terms of just making sure I'm focusing on the next ball. That's been a big thing for me, because ultimately in this game, things can change pretty quickly. And I found early on in the first game I played at Cardiff that I bowled an over at Ben Duckett and things got a little bit away from me. And the learning from that was very much about, right, how do you stop that from happening, and how do you stop like batters getting on top of you? So we've worked a little bit on that, but he's put a lot of faith in me, and I've made it sort of no secret ever since I made my debut for Warwickshire. That's been big for me, is people backing me and feeling 100% a part of things. And I feel that allows me to go out and express myself, enjoy my cricket, and ultimately execute my skills to the best of my ability.
Cricket Info's Matt Roller asks, does the Jay Ling celebration only come out in finals now? Talk us through that moment, dismissing Moeen Ali in a Lord's final, then that celebration.
Yeah, he's probably right. I probably need to save it for a special occasion. It's shocking, really. But I saw Carlos Brathwaite in the warm-up, actually, and he asked me if it was coming out, because originally it was his idea. When we first started the T20 Blast, he's a big United fan. And so he was happy with it. So he gave me the go-ahead to do it for Warwickshire. And then, I just, you know, as soon as I took that wicket, it was just like instant emotion, really. It was like, okay, this is unbelievable, really, to take a wicket at Lord's in a final. And it was obviously a pretty key wicket in Moeen Ali. So, yeah, just sort of lost my head a little bit and and let all that emotion out. And, gave him what he wanted.
That was great. We need more of that in cricket, definitely. Everyone knows that you're off to the CPL, you're involved in the Blast, and you just won the 100. But there's another cricket tournament you're involved with this week. Talk us through your busy week of cricket, including what you're doing on Saturday.
Yeah, so I've had a couple of days at home now, which has been really nice, because it's obviously been 5 weeks away in hotels, really. So it's been nice to spend some time with family, recharge, and luckily Warwickshire have given me a couple of days off. And then we go in, I think I'm joining up tomorrow morning, so we'll train Wednesday, train Thursday, and then travel to Kent, and then we play the quarterfinal against Kent, which is going to be a really, really tough game for us. Like, they're a really strong white ball outfit, and but we'll go there with a lot of confidence. So that's a really exciting opportunity, and the chance to get to finals day at Edgbaston, which as a Warwickshire player doesn't get much better. And then, yeah, on Saturday, my club are playing and they're top of the league. And I've actually missed playing club cricket because I've played it my whole life. So I haven't played much for the last few months. So I've missed that side of things, the banter with the boys. And ultimately, I've played a lot of my cricket through club cricket and I've got a lot of respect for it. So, yeah, I'm going to go back and play for them. We're top of the table, so we just need to win and get a few more points than the team below us. And we should be good. So that'll be good. And then Sunday morning, nice and early, I'm flying to the Caribbean to take part in the CPL. So it's going to be a busy few days, but wouldn't have it any other way.
Amazing. Amazing. On the 100 again, how did you find the competition from a playing point of view? Did you feel like it was a step up from the Blast?
Yeah, definitely. Huge step. And I think players who played in it realised that. And I think watching it as well, you could see the quality of the cricket being played. I just found, like, from a bowling perspective, as soon as you miss length or you bowl a bad ball, it's out of the park, and there's no There's no miss hits. They don't miss hit. So that was the biggest step up for me, I found. So just had to be really disciplined in my execution, and that obviously went pretty well throughout, but there were still times obviously where I found it really hard, and I haven't really come up against that in the blast yet. So yeah, it was really good. But then also the crowds and the atmosphere and the intensity around it, I found that I've never seen an intensity like it. Like, my dad came up on the train and there was just like people flooding into Lords from all angles, and it's just a pretty special time for cricket. I think there's a real buzz about it, and it's created a great environment for both women's and men's cricket at the moment.
How aware of that buzz were you during the tournament? You know, it's not often. It's been years since domestic cricket's been on free-to-air television, playing in front of literally millions on the BBC. Were you aware of that increased attention?
100%. I think I've had a lot more messages than before. Like, my phone's been pretty manic. Like, every game we've played, it's the support from everyone, friends and family, has been massive, and everyone's been able to watch it. But then also just like around the ground, like walking to the nets, and there's such a buzz amongst kids, and it's great to see them all sort of relating to it and getting fully involved with it. So definitely a feeling like I've never experienced. I haven't experienced that within the blast. So yeah, it's just a heightened sort of excitement really, which has been awesome to see.
Mm. And yeah, as you mentioned, you're jetting off to the Caribbean on Sunday. How did you find out about the CPL gig?
Yeah, it came about. There was a chance that I was going to go earlier on in the 100, but then I wasn't looking likely to go because I was going to miss the first three games of the tournament because of the quarterfinal. But luckily, having performed quite well, Barbados were keen to take me, and happy with the fact that I'd missed the first three and play the last seven. And obviously Dan Vettori is the head coach, so I did well against the Phoenix, and that might have played a part, I don't know. But yeah, it was awesome to get that call and get that opportunity. I'm really grateful to Warwickshire actually, because you know it'd be easy for them to not let me go. We've got quite a big September coming up with Championship fixtures, and really I'm really fortunate that Mark Robinson and Paul Farbrace have been so supportive, and allowing me to go and play in this tournament, because it's obviously a fantastic opportunity, and you know, hopefully if I can put in some really good performances out there, more opportunities will come up.
Mm. And finally, your Twitter bio still reads director of cricket at the school you work for. Has the speed of your success this year meant you've had to change any of your plans reteaching, which when we spoke earlier in the year you were very keen to still do?
Yeah, no, it's definitely changed things. It's been hard to do both jobs this year. Everything sort of with the 100 coming in and preparing for the blast prior to that in term time, it was challenging. So I think my plan is to step back a little bit from the school stuff, but still try and get in when I can, because obviously that school have done a huge amount for me, both from a career perspective, but also as a student coming through. So I'm really keen to give back to those kids, and obviously it'll be great to see them having done well and get in and try and help them a little bit throughout the winter. So yeah, hopefully I'll still get the chance to go in, but I'm planning, hopefully going to be quite busy this winter, and the time would just make it too challenging really.
Just one interesting thing from my chat with him was that he's playing club cricket this Saturday.
That's great.
The day before he's going to the Caribbean Premier League, and the day after he's playing in the Blast.
it's amazing. Fantastic. And it sums up his whole story really. This is one of county cricket's great stories, and it is. A couple of my mates came to the Eliminator final on Friday, and I was telling them, you know, he's a teacher, he's just got a contract, he was teaching earlier this year, and like that they're like, really? Because that doesn't happen in other sports really, not big professional sports where there's not for money floating about. That doesn't really happen. And now the fact he's jetting off to the Caribbean, it's just perfect. And obviously you've interviewed him a couple of times now. You've been there right from the start, haven't you, Yaz? You and him.
Absolutely. I've been his biggest cheerleader.
Yeah. I saw him, it was actually quite sweet after the Eliminator. I saw him signing shirts for little kids, just handing them out. I think he was one of the few players I saw doing that. And so he's kind of, he's, you know, he's living the moment. Well,
why
would
you? What quite sweet. Has been. Yeah. Moving on, Glamorgan won their first piece of silverware in 17 years as they won the Royal London One Day Cup. They beat Durham reasonably comfortably in the final with skipper Kieran Carlson scoring 82 off 59 at number four. I caught up with Carlson, who captained his side to the trophy at the age of 23, about a season where he's been one of the leading Red Bull batters in the country, and how he felt the One Day Cup has been alongside the 100 and much more. Kieran, great to have you on the show. A fantastic week for yourself, fantastic week for the club. 80 odd in a cup final, skipping a side to the first trophy in 17 years. What do you think was key to your success as a side across the tournament?
I think we just all bought into the fact that we're here to prove a point. I think as a team, I think we kind of knew that there are kind of teams, obviously with maybe stronger teams on paper, but yeah, we knew that what we had to do was, everyone was just very excited about it, to be honest. I think it was one of those comps where we didn't think it was kind of second rate. We wanted to play and win games cricket for Glamorgan. I think that's just what kept us going. We love winning games and best feeling you can get as a cricketer. So I think we just were so dedicated to that and then wanted to do everything in our power to kind of win as many games as we could.
As a skipper, what was it like seeing some players who might not have had that many opportunities in other formats really stepping up to the increased opportunity? So for example, Joe Cook, I think, ended up as one of the tournament's leading wicket takers. He got that 60 odd as well, really important 60 odd at the back end of the tournament.
Yeah, I mean, he hasn't bowled all year, so we always knew he's kind of a bowler in terms of, like, he has the talent there, but yeah, I think with obviously injuries and other people unavailable, he had to really kind of step up and be that seamer for us. And by the end of the competition, he was my go-to man almost in the middle period. So I mean, what he's done is he's just shown what is possible when you do kind of take that opportunity and grasp it with both hands. And for him, I'm so pleased because he's obviously a great guy around the team as well. He's so committed to Glamorgan. I think he has all the talent to a very long and successful career.
There was a lot of talk about how the One Day Cup would be different this year with a lot of players missing through the 100. How did you find it personally? And do you think it's feasible for the two comps to be played alongside each other in the future?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously different at times. I think there were obviously some teams that were affected slightly more than others in terms of there was new players playing and the kind of faces you may not have recognised. But there was still, the standard of cricket was still very high, in my opinion. I think there was still obviously world-class players playing on either teams. And I think if it is going to be played alongside it, then I think it's, this year showed that the standard of cricket can be high and it can be exciting and people do kind of get behind it. Obviously, it is a little shame when people that maybe aren't playing in the hundreds aren't playing for their counties. I'm not sure if that could be kind of resolved some way, but I think that's the only thing that is maybe a little bit of a tricky issue with which may have to be resolved. But yeah, no, I think the standard of cricket was high enough for it to be feasible in the future.
We've got a couple of questions from our listeners. Joe Evans, he asks, how did Glamorgan enjoy the county championship league structure this season with the conferences? Playing Division 1 opposition, which is obviously different to how it has been for quite a long time.
Yeah, I think we as a club really enjoyed it. I think it gives bigger opportunity to lads to kind of play against those big counties. I mean, we played against Lancs and Yorkshire, which are probably two of the biggest counties in the country. And I think we kind of almost stepped our game up from there, and I think we kind of put up good competition to them and the other guys in our group. And I think it is kind of a testament to show that there may not be that much of a discrepancy between Div 1 and Div 2. And I think that's a good thing. I think the only way that county cricket is going to keep improving if every club kind of keeps improving together. Although I'm not sure if it's going to remain the same for next year or what's going to happen. But yeah, from our point of view, we love the chance to be able to play against those bigger counties with kind of the bigger names. And it feels it makes us better as players. And because that's what we want to do at the end of the day. So yeah, we've really enjoyed it.
And then on a personal level, you've had a great year so far. In the championship, you averaged 65 with a strike rate of 69. What's clicked for you this summer? You recently completed a degree. Has that coming to an end helped you?
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of it. I think I got all my exams when I was doing my exams during the season this year, but because it was all online, I didn't have to miss anything and I kind of could do it in and around it. But yeah, I think this year it's just been very clear from my perspective, just go out there and try and score as many runs as I can. And I think that's helped. There's no kind of, yeah, 50-50 there. I know that if I'm going to be aggressive and nick off, I'm going to do it. But hopefully I score more runs than I than I do when nicking off early. But no, it's been good. And I think, look, I've been supported from the coaching staff and all the staff at Glamorgan. I think that's a massive part of it. And we've done well as a team as well. I mean, I think that always helps. I think when you're struggling as a team, everything kind of seems to go bad for people personally as well. So I think the fact we are playing well as a team is a good kind of team feeling. It allows people to probably play freely and enjoy their cricket, which is ultimately when I play my best.
And just a final question about someone who everyone in the world will know about, Marnus Labuschagne. What's it like sharing a dressing room with not only one of the best cricketers on the planet, but also one of the most eccentric ones as well?
Yeah, I think it can be definitely pretty loud at times. He is eccentric, as you say, but look, he's one of those guys where he's constantly trying to improve his game and he kind of drags you along with him. There are times, obviously, he shadow bats the whole time and he's very kind of, like you say, he has his own quirks. But I think for us, he's brilliant because he's so hungry to do well and he's so hungry to kind of take you along with him. And yeah, it's been great. I mean, I hope he stays for a long time. He's a great guy. And yeah, he might be a bit weird at times, but I think everyone who plays cricket is a bit weird. So that's all right.
What's he like to bat with out in the middle?
Yeah, he's actually surprisingly relaxed. I think he knows his game so well now for a young guy that he kind of knows what he's trying to do. He tries to bat with you how you want to be batted with. So he knows that I'm more relaxed. He tries to be relaxed with me, but with other guys, he kind of changes it. And I think he's obviously turned into this superstar in world cricket. And I think he will continue to excel and keep pushing those boundaries of kind of what a good average is in test cricket. I think he doesn't want it to be, if you average 50 or you're a legend, he wants it to be 60 or 70. So I think that just shows how like progressive he is in his thinking, and there's no ceiling to where he wants to go in terms of cricket.
One other piece of news around the English game that I think is quite interesting, there's not a huge amount to discuss on it, is a story that Ali Martin broke in The Guardian today. So I'll read a quote from the story. Tom Harrison and a group of senior executives at the ECB are poised to share a projected £2.1 million bonus pot despite making 62 job cuts last year in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The most recent ECB accounts show that a five-year long-term incentive plan is due to be settled in cash in 2022, with The Guardian having learned that Harrison, the board's chief executive, who was paid £510,000 last year despite a voluntary pay cut, and Sanjay Patel, the managing director of The Hundred, are among its intended recipients. As the piece alludes to, given the cuts to the ECB in the last year, the cuts that players had as well, just the timing seems a bit jarring.
Yeah, good scoop that from Ali. Good story, or bad story, whichever way you want to look at it. But yeah, I'm surprised at that. I think the ECB had been pretty good at managing the optics over the last year or 18 months or so. And yeah, this one doesn't look so good.
Moving on, Joe, what's your moment of the week?
So mine is a feel-good story from Australia, with Australian cricket in crisis. Justin Langer has received the dreaded vote of confidence from Cricket Australia. They released a statement saying, "Justin has done an incredible job in raising the culture, values and behaviours of the Australian men's team since he took on the role in 2018. His efforts have restored public faith in the national team, which is a side all Australians can be incredibly proud of." They go on to say, "Despite those challenges over the last 18 months, the side has had great success in one-day test and T20 cricket when all players were available." The great success in test cricket is interesting because in the period they're talking about, they've only played one series, which they lost at home to a heavily depleted Indian side. So that's slightly odd, but there is a feeling, a growing sense that the players don't want him, at least a section of the players don't want him. The Aussie press, from what I've read, seem thoroughly fed up of him. And his style of coaching has really started to grate on people. And you can tell that from the number of leaks that have started to come out of the camp. There was the recent one where him and the Australian team manager were kind of seen berating Cricket Australia's digital journalist for publishing a video of Bangladesh celebrating their T20 series victory over Australia, which is Cricket Australia's website's job. They are kind of an odd sort of quasi-independent thing. That's what they do. If you're picking fights with a digital journalist, it suggests there might be other area of concern that might be causing that. The players are clearly unhappy. There's a good piece by Sam Perry on the Guardian website yesterday in which he reports that Tim Payne, Pat Cummins and Aaron Finch were preparing for a meeting to kind of have the opportunity to com- to communicate their concerns to Cricket Australia. But then the public vote of confidence came out before they'd even had those meetings. So essentially their views are meaningless in that context. So this support, while it is there, it feels shaky. It feels like if they flunk out of the T20 World Cup, which based on recent form is very possible, things might get quite interesting. We might be kind of back to Mickey Arthur 2013, who was sacked as Australia coach, what, 3 weeks before the Ashes started?
Yeah. I guess the difference is this time, they're, however badly they might be doing, they still would go into that series as favourites.
And that's what Sam Perry says. He says that at this point, Australia could coach themselves to victory over this England team, and he's probably right. But, you know, perhaps as we're in slightly in the doldrums in Test cricket at the moment in England, there is a sort of glimmer of hope that the Aussies might implode and let us in the back door, and maybe we can sneak a win or two.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Either way, I mean, Langer, he's watching that documentary on Amazon. I mean, his coaching style would certainly grate on me, and it would have taken quite a lot less time than it's taken the Australian players to get pissed off. But he has got this playing record behind him, which kind of all makes him
untouchable,
but that all seems to be rubbing off, and he's definitely in the press's crosshairs, and some of the players too, it seems.
Malcolm Conn, who used to be the Cricket Australia media manager, he wrote a really scathing piece about what it's like to work with Langer, which is actually something you don't really ever get to see get publicly aired whilst the guy's still in their job.
Well, yeah, it was almost like a kind of expose, wasn't it? And Langer must have been livid about that as well, because he would have seen Malcolm Connors kind of in his inner sanctum, and then he leaves, and this is all put out there. But you know, that is, if you employ a journalist to be your media manager, and then he moves on, this is the sort of thing that's going to happen. And Malcolm Conn's completely within his rights to do so, and is interesting and really reinforced the sense that, yeah, all is not well.
Moving on, a plug for Botham Dinners. To celebrate the 40th anniversary of Botham's Ashes, the Sporting Club are running a series of dinners over the course of the summer. The next two are coming up at the Oval on the 9th of September and Headingley on the 15th of September. Head to the Sporting Club website to get your tickets. Last week, Yorkshire released a statement regarding their investigation into allegations of racism at the club. I'm not going to read the entirety out. I'll read some of the most relevant bits out now. In September 2020, Yorkshire County Cricket Club launched a full investigation into allegations of racism made by former player Azeem Rafiq, spanning back to 2008. We aim to publish as much of the report and recommendations as we are able, subject to any legal restraints on doing so in the coming weeks. It is right, however, to acknowledge from the outset that several of the allegations made by Azeem were upheld, and that sadly, historically, Azeem was the victim of inappropriate behaviour. This is clearly unacceptable. We would like to express our profound apologies for this. Rafiq has since said in an interview with ESPN Quick Info that he thinks that the positions of Yorkshire Chief Executive Mark Arthur and the club's Director of Cricket Martin Moxon are untenable. I don't think there's a huge amount that we can add ourselves until we've seen the report, but is there anything either of you would like to say on that?
This week's going to be a jarring one, because we know the match is going to be at Headingley. I think England have said they're going to wear those T-shirts again, which from the outset felt a bit hollow, especially when, you know, they took the knee last summer, stopped taking the knee, and now it's almost like an alternative way to not take that gesture. It's just going to be an odd experience.
It's very odd. We're all stuck in limbo with this story because Yorkshire haven't let anyone see the report. I know that ECB have requested it. I don't know if that's happened yet. I understand they were pretty livid that they hadn't been able to see the report when they're trying to do lots of positive work about tackling discrimination and opening up the game. This is not only really bad news from Yorkshire's point of view, it looks terrible from the whole game's perspective. Joe Root spoke really well about it in the lead up to this test match, and his understanding of Azeem Rafiq's, like, how hurt he is by all of this, and how, I mean, that term inappropriate behaviour, which Azeem Rafiq called out himself and said that is no way sums up what happened. It was completely wrong. I mean, I can't believe that has actually passed through however many people it's been looked at, and they decide inappropriate behaviour is the right term to use there. I mean, it's been botched every step of the way so far. And yeah, we're still none the wiser, really, other than the few leaks that have come out, what they're going to do about it.
And over a year since Taha's article was first published as well, which is crazy. Finally, West Indies Pakistan, the second and final test of that series is going on at the moment. We're recording this just before the start of day five. It started disastrously for Pakistan. Kemal Roach and Jaden Seals reduced them to 2 for 3 on the first morning. And then Babar Azam and Fawad Alam led the recovery. Babar with 75 and Fawad Alam with his 500 in Test cricket in just 13 matches. A Shaheen 6 for helped bowl West Indies out for 150 after the second day was washed out. And then Pakistan declared on day four, leaving West Indies with 329 to win with a bit of rain around on the final day. But it's arguably quite a generous declaration. They've given them plenty of time to get the runs if they wish to go for them. West Indies finished day five 1 down. Kieran Powell was run out for 23, coming back for a third, not grounding his bat. And that wasn't even the funniest dismissal from day four, actually. When Pakistan were going for some quick runs towards the end of their innings, Craig Brathwaite bowled a 37-mile-per-hour moon ball to Azhar Ali that he just got a top edge and it spooned so slowly to short fine leg. Worth finding a clip of that if you can. Anyway, that's all we've got time for on today's show. This has been the Wisden Cricket Weekly Podcast. Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Taha. We'll be back next week to look back at the third England-India Test match. Cheers.
Podcast Network.